So, session two. God can't learn, be surprised, or change his mind. Can someone remind me what time I'm supposed to finish? Because I'm conscious that... Great. And is there anything else for us to do after I finish talking? There probably is. Sing once more. Okay, so 2 minutes to one. Right. Okay, here we go. We're on London time, aren't we? Good. All right. So, let's start with God can't learn. Seems like a strange thing to say, because for us, not being able to learn is not generally seen as a good thing. And there have been various points in my life where it could truly be said of me, Nick can't learn. None of them have been particularly things that I'd want to put on my CV. But perhaps you know the feeling of being in a lesson at school or maybe a session on the church weekend where, you know, the information just keeps on coming and there's a point at which your brain gives up and waves a little white flag and says, that's plenty, thank you. And you're just so full, it just doesn't feel like you can get any more in. And it's like, you could tell me a million new things and I wouldn't learn one of them now because I haven't been able to process what's coming in. I sort of think about it a bit like a water butt in the garden. So my dad has a bunch of these sort of green plastic barrels in the garden that catch rainwater. And he's got this very sort of intricate series of contraptions by which he kind of waters the garden from it. But it's a way of kind of catching the water that comes off the roof of the house and the garden shed and that kind of thing. So there it is. It's something you're trying to put water into. And if you think about water as being knowledge and the water butt as being you, there are various reasons why you might not be able to learn, why you might not be able to get any more water into the water butt. And the first, I guess, obviously, is it's full. So there's no space for any more to go in. Okay, so I think that's why I've started forgetting, important things like my children's names. It's to make space for new information to get in. So that could be one reason. Another reason might be that the water butt has cracked, and so any water that goes in just leaks out again. On one occasion, when I was about 14, someone threw a tennis ball at me in the playground at school. I thought this was a terrible thing to do, so I dived at his head. He ducked. I went straight over the top, knocked myself out, and couldn't learn anything new for quite some time. So I didn't know what day it was. I knew where I lived. I knew my phone number. But I couldn't store new memories. I'd banged my head so hard. And so I spent a night in hospital and a couple of weeks off school because I'm an idiot. And I'm sure banging my head didn't help. But that's the idea of the sort of cracked water butt. Something's broken, you can't get anything in. There are various other things that could have happened. The pipe might be blocked. I might not be able to understand what you're saying to me because I've got wax in my ears or whatever. As creatures, to say we can't learn, when that's written on my school report, I'm not looking forward to my parents reading that. But so for creatures, not being able to learn is a deficiency, okay? But when it comes to God, it is a sign of his immense greatness and glory. So think about it like this. There is one reason that we haven't considered why the water butt might not be able to be filled with any more water. What reason is that? Well, what if the water butt already contains all the water in the universe? Now, it's a big water butt, admittedly, but let's just imagine, theoretically, we can imagine that could be possible, right? You couldn't get any more water in because there is no more water to put in. And when we talk about God not being able to learn, that's what we mean, that there is no new information for him to absorb. There is nothing that he doesn't already perfectly possess in terms of knowledge. So he cannot learn. It's actually even bigger than that, but we'll start there. And Psalm 139, I will read for us in just a moment. But as I do, again, I'd like you to be asking some questions because I'd like you to discuss them with your neighbours in a moment. Or to discuss them with yourself as you fold your arms and scowl to drive others away. So here are the three questions. Two are the same as we asked of Isaiah 40. So what does God know? And how does God know it? And then the third question, this is a psalm of David. What effect does God's knowledge have on David? Okay? Okay, what effect does God's knowledge have on David? So here we go, Psalm 139. To the choir master, a psalm of David. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down, and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in behind and before, and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the lights about me be night, even the darkness is not as dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God! How vast is the sum of them! If I would count them, they are more than the sand. I awake, and I am still with you. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God! O men of blood, depart from me! They speak against you with malicious intent. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me, and know my thoughts. And see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. So what does God know? How does God know what he knows? And what effect does that have on David? Okay, let's have a chat together for a few minutes around those questions. Okay. Great, well done. Okay, so same rules as before. If you've got something to say, I'll ask you just to point us to a verse. So, what does God know? And look, I'll say the obvious thing, all right? God knows everything, fine, okay. but what sorts of things does God know? Because I think there are things within everything that we might not normally have included within everything, if you know what I mean. And that we might have thought, these are things you can't know. Yeah. Great, can you just point us to a couple of verses for that? Great, thank you. You've searched me and known me. And then, you know, it comes out just how deep that goes. It's not just where I am, it's not just what I say, but it's what I think. And actually, it's even what I'm going to think before I think it. Before a word is on my lips, Lord, you know it completely. That's quite striking, isn't it? Before a word is on my tongue. Before I've even started to think about what it is that I'm going to say. It's not just that God is really... You know the thing with Google? You can type things into Google and it will complete the search for you. And you can have quite a lot of fun with that. I should have done it for Greenwich. You can type in, like, why is... You know, and then you put the name of a town. You know, why is Hove so fantastic? That's the first thing, it obviously. you know, completes for you. But it thinks it knows what you're going to ask. Yeah? So you could try it. You could type in, why is Greenwich so? And then see what it you know, thinks you're going to ask it. It's quite a fun game. You can learn quite a lot about the UK just by doing that with Google. But Google will complete your search for you before you've finished it because it thinks it knows what you're going to ask. It can predict. That's how AI works. My understanding is that with ChatGPT, all it is a probability engine that tells you what the most likely next word is in response to a particular query. But that's not how God's working, is it? Because he's not just kind of going on the basis of what's there, and he's ahead of David. He knows David better than David knows himself. And actually that's true, isn't it? Not just of David's mind and what David thinks, but of David's body as well. God knows his inner parts, the bits that you really don't want to know about yourself, in one sense. You know, if you see your intestines, you're in big trouble, generally. They're meant to be hidden away. But God knows them all. He put them together. Is there anything else God knows that the future gone? Great, thank you. So God knows the future as well as he knows the present or the past. That's going to be an important thing for us to think about under the next section as well. God can't be surprised. The future is as known to him as the present is. So that every one of my days was known to him. That raises some questions for us, doesn't it, which we'll talk about a little bit. But anything else? Yes. He knows what happens in the darkness. Fantastic, thank you. So, yeah, nothing is hidden from him at all. And the things that we would think of as being unknowable, the things that are hidden away inside our heart, inside our minds, inside our bodies, they're not hidden from him. And darkness and light are... It's not that he can see in the dark like someone with night vision goggles. I've never worn a pair of night vision goggles, but you see them in the films, don't you? And everything is this kind of weird green as it's kind of... just amplifying a particular wavelength of light. And night vision goggles, you can't see in the dark with them. You can just see what's there a bit better. But that's not what God's relationship to darkness is at all, is it? He doesn't need light to see. The darkness is as light to him. Which begins to raise the question, doesn't it? How does God know what God knows? Let's think about seeing and light and dark. So God doesn't see by means of light, radiation reflecting off surfaces. That's how we see. It's just reflected light. Well, apparently that's not on the table for God, because light and darkness, there's no difference at all. So how does God know what he knows? Yeah, go on. Verse 16, thank you very much. So in your book were written every one of my days, for one of them came to be. God wrote the script in the first place. He doesn't know things in the way that we know them. And as you go through the psalm, you see that. There's stuff that's observable, like, you know, when I stand up and when I sit down, and you know, when I rise, you know, when I go to bed. You know, those sorts of things that a decent private detective could find out for him. But then it starts to move into the sorts of things that don't seem or feel knowable, like, you know, my thoughts, or even deeper than that, whatever it is that's there before my thoughts, from which my thoughts come, before a word is on my lips. You know it completely. Light and dark are the same thing. I don't know about you, but I always think one of the things that I've really been helped with by studying the scriptures around who God is this. Naturally, I think of God as being like me, just a lot bigger and better. Okay? I don't mean, you know, looking like me, but I mean, you know, that he's basically like a kind of really superhuman. Okay? But God's not like that at all. We're made in his image, but his experience of being is nothing like our experience of being. So I always thought, well, God, thinking about prayer, for instance, thinking, how does God hear our prayers? I always thought about sort of God sitting up there in heaven and all the sort of things that we pray out loud kind of coming up to him, and God somehow having really good hearing so he could hear my thoughts as well. And that being how God works, that he sits there up in heaven and the information comes to him, almost like a kind of space station or a satellite with all the information from earth being sort of beamed out into heaven and him sort of sitting there receiving it. But it's not, that's totally not how God knows things. He doesn't receive what you might call sense data. So sense data is the data that comes into our minds through our senses, through our ears, our eyes, our sense of touch, our sense of smell, all of that. We know our surroundings, we know what's going on around us by means of that sense data that comes in. But God doesn't know things by sense data, which is why he can have access to knowledge of things where there is no sense data available, like what I'm thinking, or, you know, light and darkness being no different. Sense data isn't the thing, you see. How does God know? Well, as we've heard, God knows by creating. He knows because the universe continues on its course, because he speaks it into being and he upholds it with his powerful word. So actually God knows everything completely backwards. The way he knows things is backwards from the way that we know things. Just on the next page of the handout, I've given you this quote from Augustine's City of God. Augustine, an absolutely sort of monumental figure in kind of Western intellectual history, and one of the best Christian theologians there's ever been. This is how he talks about it. The world could not have been known to us unless it existed. In other words, for us to have true knowledge of something, it's got to exist, and we've got to receive sort of sense data about it. The world could not be known to us unless it existed, but it could not have existed unless it had been known to God. So just like those stars that he calls out by name, the only reason the stars are there is because he calls their names. So he knows the stars before the stars are. And he knows us before we even come into existence. Before you were born, before you were even conceived, God knew you. And he knew everything about you, and he knew everything about your life. So he didn't need your life to happen for him to know your life. Actually, you needed him to know your life for it to happen. Which, actually, when you start trying to think about it, it's really hard. In fact, it's too hard. You cannot know what it is like for God to know things. He knows all of reality that ever has been or ever will be. He knows it all in one perfect act of knowing before any of it comes to be. Good luck trying to process what that looks like. But what it does tell us is that God's knowledge is perfect. In the way that God is perfect, his knowledge is perfect. There's nothing missing. So that he actually knows the relative positions and movement of every subatomic particle in the whole of this universe. And all of their relations to and effects on each other from the beginning of time to the last syllable of recorded time. He knows all of it perfectly. Nothing is hidden from him. So in Isaiah 40 terms, why do you say, O Israel, why do you complain, O Jacob, my way is hidden from my God. My cause is disregarded by my God. There's nothing hidden from him. Now what effect does that have on David in Psalm 139? What does that do to him? It comforts him. Okay, great. Where do you get that? Your Yeah, so regardless of his circumstances, God sees him, God knows him, God can keep him safe. So it comforts him in the places where otherwise he would be anxious and afraid. Thank you. Anything else? Humbles him, great. Where do you get that? Great. Verse 6. Yeah, too wonderful for me, so high I cannot attain it. So it's interesting, isn't it? I think when I start thinking about deeply about Psalm 139, my brain starts to hurt, and I start to think, I don't really understand this. I mean, I understand what it's saying. I think I get the point, but I cannot imagine what it is like for God to know in the way that God knows. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too high. And actually, there should be that sort of experience of when we really think about the deep things of God, actually, there's a point at which we go, yeah, no, my brain can't actually cope with this. I can't compute this. I can't think about what it is like for God to be God. It is humbling. It reveals our creatureliness, our limitedness to us. Because it's not, with most human knowledge, there is a sort of sense that if you kind of bang your head against it hard enough, if you think about it hard enough, if you work hard enough, if you think long enough, with most things, you probably could understand it. But this is a kind of knowledge that you do not have the capacity for, because your brain is finite. You know, it could never be infinite, because you're a creature, not the creator. So it is humbling. Yeah, absolutely. What else does it do to David? Oh, yes, sorry, hello. Yes, okay, great. So he 7 and 8. So he finds God absolutely inescapable. And that's going to do something to how he thinks about his relationship with God, isn't it? And about how he thinks about his own life. So this is no longer really kind of contemporary culture, I have to admit. But have you seen the film The Truman Show? Is that a film you've seen? So The Truman Show is the idea of this man whose whole life, from conception onwards, has been a reality TV show. And he is the only person who doesn't know that. So there's this film director who's kind of captured him in a false world, in which everything he does, every conversation he has, everything, even with himself in the mirror, is all recorded and broadcast to the world. Every person in his life is an actor or an actress. And he begins to wake up to the fact that he's trapped in this fake world, this fake universe, this fake life. And he decides he wants to escape. And he climbs on board a sailing boat. And if you haven't seen the film, I'm sorry, I'm just destroying it for you. But he climbs on board a sailing boat and decides to sort of sail across the sea to escape this kind of fake life that he's been imprisoned in. Does anyone know what the number on the sail of that boat is? Can you guess? It's 139. Where can I go from your presence? Where can I flee from your spirit? And so the picture you have in The Truman Show is of, you know, the true man trying to escape the fake world of the God who's got him imprisoned and seek freedom and authenticity. And the number that sort of stands on the sail of the boat that's taking him to freedom kind of speaks of that sort of sense of being trapped in someone else's reality. And he's trying to flee. He's trying to escape. And he does escape. He wins, you see. He's the true man. It's an interesting film. It really is. But so for someone who doesn't know God, who doesn't trust God, who doesn't love God, Psalm 139 sounds very threatening, doesn't it? I can't go anywhere in reality and escape you. And there is nothing in my life, nothing. I'm not even safe from you in my own mind. And it feels terribly frightening and oppressive. And yet for David, it's not frightening or oppressive, is it? It's humbling, yes, but it's comforting. Your right hand will hold me fast. Indeed, it leads him, doesn't it, to worship, verses 17 and 18. So, how precious to me are your thoughts, O God, how vast is the sum of them. If I could count them, they're more than the sand. I awake and I'm still with you. So there's this sort of wonder, how precious to me are your thoughts? How vast is the sum of them? And then we're back with sand and stars, aren't we? You know, were I to be able to count your thoughts, they would be like the sand. We've already thought about how futile it is to try and count sand. And then beautifully, end of verse 18, there's this picture that actually, as David reflects on God's unsleeping knowledge, he sleeps. So he says, when I awake, I'm still with you. You know, it actually, you kind of get the feeling of David counting God's thoughts being like someone counting sheep. Does that make sense to you? It's a peculiar English idiom, isn't it? Counting sheep. But the idea is that, you know, if you can't nod off at night, that you lie in bed and count sheep jumping over a gate, and counting sheep is so mind-numbingly boring that you fall asleep pretty quickly, because sheep all look the same. And there's no interest in it at all. David similarly has a way of falling asleep whilst trying to count the sum of God's thoughts. So it drives him to humility, to wonder, to worship. And then verses 19 to 21, to 22 rather, is the bit that often you don't hear read. Certainly if like me you go to lots of Church of England services, Psalm 139 is lovely until you get to verse 19, and no one quite knows what to do with it. Suddenly he's saying, would you slay the wicked? It stops being kind of, oh, it's so lovely thinking about how God knows everything about me and I can go to sleep, and then suddenly it's like, if only you would slay the wicked. O men of blood, depart from me, they speak against you with malicious intent. I don't know what you think is going on there. Here's what I think, is that as David reflects on who God is through the idea of God's knowledge, through thinking about what God knows, David is just opened up to the wonder and the beauty of who God is, to his ultimate goodness, to his rightful sort of supremacy and glory. And he's just filled with love for God. And the thing about loving something is you hate whatever sets itself up against what you love, don't you? Like, you know, there's nothing in nature, you know, there's nothing more dangerous than, you know, a mother separated from her cub. You know, deer in this country, for instance, are fairly sort of safe and placid. But if you get in the way of a mother deer and her babies, then suddenly they're very dangerous. And the same is true of lots of animals, because that's what love is like. Love is fierce. You know, love hates what sets itself up against the thing that is loved. You know, and probably we all know that experience, don't we? You see it with football teams or whatever. Perfectly nice people can become absolute animals when it comes to sort of defending what's good. I suppose we saw it even, didn't we, for those of you who follow cricket, in the long room of the MCC at Lords last week, when, you know, the Aussies were up to their old tricks again. And the normally very genteel people in the long room became pretty rabid as their beloved spirit of cricket was under attack. That's what I think is going on. David falls in love with God. He's absolutely overwhelmed with the goodness of God and recognizes that anything that sets itself up against God is genuinely evil. That people to speak of God with evil intent is to be absolutely committed to evil. And David loves good, so he hates evil. So this isn't a kind of encouragement for believers to sort of start hating other people. It is an expression of the power of David's love for God. And so if I love God, I hate what is against God. That's the picture. It's not a picture of encouraging sort of hateful behavior or superiority to others, for reasons that we'll see elsewhere in scripture. But he cannot stand the idea that people would speak against God, because God is utterly, perfectly, wonderfully good. And so he takes the opposite, verses 23 to 24, he takes the opposite course from Truman in The Truman Show. And instead of saying, I want to escape the gaze of God, he submits himself to it. And he says, because I know that you're good, and this is the thing about him hating what is evil, what he actually says is, even those things that I hold dear in my heart, even those ways in which I worship idols, those ways in which there are things of the dark that I cling to, David says, God, search me. See if there's any unclean way in me. And lead me in the way everlasting. So actually he sees the goodness of God to the extent that he's willing to say, I want you to cut out of me the things that I love wrongly. The evil that I cherish in my soul. The sin that I'm not willing to let go of. He says, Lord, search me. Find those things. Show me those things. Lead me in the right path. It's futile to try and hide from God, isn't it? It's futile to live a life partly in the dark, thinking, you know, these things that I keep secret from the rest of the world, God won't know about. You know, God is not foiled by deleting your internet history. He's not foiled by you going to another part of town, or going to another town or another country. The sorts of things where we think, you know, the normal rules don't apply because I'm hidden. I'm away from normal life. Maybe I only think about that kind of thing because I've been part of several rugby clubs, and, you know, there's that old sort of thing of, you know, what goes on tour stays on tour. There's that kind of mentality that, you know, if no one knows, it didn't happen. Well, that's not true with God, is it? Okay, so God knows everything he can't learn, for that reason, and connected to that, very quickly, he can't be surprised. So we've seen that in Psalm 139, haven't we, that the past is and the future are as well known to God as the present. Now we ask the question in response to that, the natural response to that is to say, well, if God knows, you know, everything that's going to happen in my life, everything I'm ever going to think, everything I'm ever going to say before I'm even born, in what sense am I actually free? In what sense am I actually responsible for the way that I live? Am I not just a character in a story that God is writing? Doesn't that mean that there's no point in me? I'm not a moral being, really. I'm just like a robot. And that would be one kind of natural, logical way that you might respond to that piece of information that, you know, every one of your days has been written in God's book before one of them came to be. And yet, that's not a conclusion that Scripture allows us to draw. So if you just flick back with me to Genesis chapter 50, very quickly, in verse 20, page 44 of the Bibles. So, too much background to explain clearly, but Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers. He's become their rescuer. Their dad has just died, and they're worried that Joseph is going to finally get his revenge on them. And so the brothers say, your father gave this command before he died. That's verse 16. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones. What you intended for evil, God intended for good, says Joseph. So are the brothers fulfilling God's plan? Has what's happened, which has resulted in God's people not dying in a famine because of where Joseph is, where he was sold into slavery, he has prospered and brought prosperity to Egypt and been able to save the brothers. Were they actually doing what God had always planned that they would do? Yes, they were. What you intended for evil, God intended for good. God was at work. It was his intention that they should do what they did. But it's also what they wanted to do. They did it for their own reasons. They made their own choices, their own decisions. What you intended for evil. So they intended it, and they intended to do something bad, but God in his great wisdom turned it into something good. And you can look up Acts 2:23 later, but it's Peter saying exactly the same thing about the crucifixion of Jesus. You know, you put him to death at the hands of wicked men. The crucifixion of Jesus was a genuinely evil act. In fact, the most evil act in the history of humanity. We tried to murder our creator. And yet, Peter says, this was done by the divine plan and foreknowledge of God. God knew it, he planned it, but evil people did evil things. But even in that most evil act, God brought about a really good thing, the salvation of people. So the scriptures say, look, both things are true. You do what you want to do. You make your own decisions. You're a moral agent. You're responsible for your actions. And yet somehow at the same time, God is at work and everything that happens in his world happens according to his plan. And the moral responsibility for evil lies on the creatures that make evil decisions. God is not evil in incorporating those things into his plans. And yet both those things are true. You're a moral being. You make decisions. There are things you want to do and you do them because you want to do them. And God has a plan for his whole creation and he's working it out and there's not one hair out of place. And you cannot imagine how both those, you can't sort of find a mechanism for thinking about how both those things can be true at once. At least I don't think you can. No one ever has that I'm aware of that is genuinely satisfactory. But we can say that, you know, God reveals those things to us as true. And you see it most clearly in the crucifixion of Jesus. There's a little moment in a book by a chap called Hilary of Poitiers, which I'm just going to find if I can, that I quote in the book. So it's over a similar kind of issue to this. It's not identical, but talking about heretics, false teachers outside the church who are trying to undo the teaching. And he says that basically the problem is they think if they don't understand it, it can't be true. So this is what he says. All unbelief is foolishness, for it takes such wisdom as its own finite perception can attain, and measuring infinity by that petty scale, concludes that what it cannot understand must be impossible. Unbelief is the result of incapacity engaged in argument. Men are sure that an event never happened because they've made up their minds that it could not happen. So when the scriptures reveal to us a God who knows everything, including the future, and reveals to us that we are moral beings who are responsible for our actions, we can't figure out how that works or how that fits together. But the fact that we can't do that doesn't mean it's not true. Actually, there are a number of things. When you're a finite creature coming up against an infinite God, there are a number of points at which you have to say, I cannot understand how this can be. I cannot understand God from God's point of view. But that doesn't make what God says about himself in Scripture untrue. And that God knows the future is fundamental to the idea of who God is. So in Isaiah 44, it's the test of whether the gods of the nations are really gods or not. Isaiah says, well, let them tell the future and let's see if it happens. Because the true God knows the future as well as he knows the present or the past. Okay, we're going to stop there and we'll pick up God not changing his mind later on. Because whilst God can't change his mind, I can, and I've decided that we're not going to try and plough on to the end of the session.
God doesn't make predictions about the future. He knows it. Just as I can't make predictions about the past, I'm not sort of guessing what might have happened. What's happened has happened. To God, the future is like that. So when he says, never will I leave you or forsake you, founded not just on his character, but on his knowledge as well. He knows that he will never leave you or forsake you. And that brings us on to the third thing, which is that God can't change his mind. So I've given you a quote from 1 Samuel 15:29, where God is speaking to Saul through Samuel and telling Saul that he's been rejected as king and that isn't going to change. He says, "He who is the glory of Israel does not lie or change his mind." But he's not a human being that he should change his mind. So you'll remember we were talking this morning about the idea of this distinction between the creator and the creature. God is not like us. And actually, when it comes to things like changing his mind, God actually says, "I don't change my mind. I can't change my mind because I'm not like you. I'm not a human being. Human beings change their mind. They're totally changeable. But I'm not like that." So the same is true in Numbers chapter 23, verse 19. Perhaps just turn there with me on page 132. So Numbers 23 is this extraordinary chapter in the Bible where God has, this whole kind of, from chapter 22, through to chapter 24, where Balak, a king, as he sees the people of Israel being led through the wilderness, and he sees how great they are, and sees how God is blessing them, he becomes afraid that they will fight against his nation and destroy it. And so he calls a prophet called Balaam or Balaam, depending on your preference for pronunciation. And he says, "You come and pronounce a curse on Israel. You come and call down God's cursing on this people." And every time that Balaam or Balaam tries to curse Israel, he can't. All he can do is bless them. Because God says, "I have decided that these are my people. I'm going to bless them. That's what I've promised." And this is what he says through Balaam in chapter 23, beginning at verse 18 on page 132. "Rise, Balak, and hear. Give ear to me, O son of Zippor. God is not man that he should lie, or a son of man that he should change his mind. Has he said, and he will not do it? Or has he spoken, and will he not fulfill it? Behold, I receive the command to bless. He has blessed, and I cannot revoke it. He has not beheld misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel. The Lord their God is with them, and the shout of a king is among them. God brings them out of Egypt, and is for them like the horns of a wild ox. There is no enchantment against Jacob, no divination against Israel. Now it shall be said of Jacob and Israel, what has God wrought? Behold, a people. As a lioness it rises up, and as a lion it lifts itself. It does not lie down until it has devoured the prey and drunk the blood of the slain." And in other words, Israel cannot be defeated because God has decreed that they shall triumph. They shall not be destroyed as a nation because God has made promises to them. And he cannot, he will not change his mind because he is not like us. So when God makes a promise like the promise in Psalm 110, "You are priest forever in the order of Melchizedek," which is picked up in Hebrews chapter 2, and used of Jesus, speaking of how Jesus is a mediator, a priest forever. And it says he will not change his mind. In other words, what God has done for us in the gospel of Jesus, what Jesus has done as our priest, as the one who has made a sacrifice on our behalf, will never be undone. God will never think to himself, "Actually, do you know what? I'm quite bored of the church now. I've got interested in something else." He won't change his mind because he is utterly and perfectly constant. He's perfect. Any change for God, if you add anything to him, you just make him worse. If you take anything away, you just make him worse. In fact, he is no longer God in any recognizable sense. And we've thought about knowledge. There's no new knowledge to give him. And why do we change our minds? It's an interesting question, isn't it? I think there are two basic reasons that we change our minds. Things that are outside and things that are inside. So things that are outside, sometimes I change my mind because I learn new that's quite a good reason for changing your mind, isn't it? Is where the facts change, or at least my appreciation of the facts change. So I might think that one of my children has done a terrible thing, and I decide that they're going to be grounded for some time, and then I discover that it wasn't them at all, it was their sibling. I've changed my mind, you're not going to be grounded, there you are. Right? So we change our minds because of things from the outside, we gain new information, the situation outside us changes. Well, God gains many new information, he can't be surprised, he doesn't learn anything. So he's not going to change his mind because there's facts or circumstances change, he's not like us, he doesn't gain knowledge. So then it would have to be something from the inside. And sometimes I change my mind because of things on the inside, because of things deep in my psyche or the things in my body. The chemical balance of our body can change and cause our minds to change a bit. Sort of things deep in our subconscious minds can produce changes in us that we don't necessarily understand, but we change our minds for those reasons anyway. With God, he is perfect. He's perfectly realized every good thing. So there's nothing inside him that could or should be different. So he's not going to change his mind because he changes inside, and he's not going to change his mind because we change on the outside. What have you got left? Why would he change his mind? He's not a human being that he should and he won't, which means that we can trust him completely. In fact, he is more reliable than the things that we normally think of as being reliable and solid. Jesus, the God who we saw at the end of, or at the beginning of the second session, God doesn't sleep, and yet Jesus is sleeping. He experiences human limitation. When it comes to knowledge, you see that at the beginning, particularly of Luke's Gospel, where we read in Luke 2:53 that he grew in wisdom and stature. And Luke seems to really want to stress this because Luke 2.40 and Luke 1.80 are almost identical. Luke 1.80 describes the development of John the Baptist, Jesus' half-cousin. Well, this makes him a cousin, actually. John the Baptist grows in stature and in favour. And then in Luke 2.40, we read the same about Jesus. In other words, what I think Luke is trying to do is to show us that Jesus experiences normal human development. He grows up. That's actually quite a weird thing to think about, isn't it? The idea that here is someone who is truly the living God, who at the same time is growing up, is coming to maturity, both physically and mentally. And we're going to think about this more again at the end of the session, but right at the heart of the Christian faith is this almost impossible to understand thing that the infinite God has become finite, has taken on a human nature, that the person of the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God, has taken to himself a human nature and so has shared our limitations and knows in all things except for what it is to be guilty of sin, what it is like for us to be human beings in this world. And he genuinely, truly has a human mind, so that the God who can't learn went to school. And our minds are limited, and our time bound, they gain information. All of those things are true of Jesus in his human nature. He grows up in wisdom. And thinking about the reality of Jesus' human mind is actually very helpful to us in a number of ways. On the one hand, it helps us to make sense of things like how Jesus can truly be God and say, but the day and the hour of the Son of Man's coming are not known to me. How can Jesus be ignorant of something and still be God when God is omniscient? Well, as a man, there are limits to his knowledge. We thought about how God knows, didn't we, earlier? God's knowledge is infinite. And God knows everything all at once. And he doesn't move from one thing to the next in the way that we do. Because he knows by creating. difference between your sort of conscious and your subconscious mind is helpful, but not, but doesn't go all the way. So there are things I know that I don't have access to until something triggers that access. So have you ever had that experience where you smell something and you suddenly remember something you didn't even know that you knew? Because the smell center in your brain is right next to the memory center in your brain. And so smells can trigger memories.